hear argument now in the case of Reyes against Remington Hybrid Seed Company.
Good morning. I represent two groups, two migrant farm worker families, the Reyes and the Garcias, who are appealing the summary judgment that was granted in favor of Remington Hybrid Seed Company, John Overbeck and Steve Hageman. The district court decided that summary judgment was proper in this case because it concluded that Remington did not employ the migrant farm workers who rogued into the tassel Remington seed corn crop within the meaning of the Agriculture Worker Protection Act, which is often referred to as the APA, and the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is often referred to as the FLISA.
Yes, and if you would use English rather than acronyms, I would much appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor. Both of these statutes define employ as to suffer or permit to work.
Yeah, can I stop you there?
Yes, Your Honor.
What role, if any, do you think that the seven factors that were applied by the district court should have in analyzing the suffer or permit to work standard?
I believe that those factors, which sometimes are referred to as the economic reality test, are a shorthand reminder.
I'm so glad you didn't say ERT.
Thank you, Judge. Are sometimes a shorthand reminder to courts to look beyond the technical distinctions and self-serving statements that of subjective intent, contracts or the labels that sometimes are applied in these sort of relationships. And so I think those factors are just what are used to get beyond the formalistic labels that are applied to the relationships.
Now, are you challenging only the district court's legal conclusions, or are you asserting that the court failed to consider all reasonable inferences in favor of the plaintiffs in considering the facts?
I believe both, Your Honor. The two issues that we're appealing in this case are whether Remington employed this group of migrant farm workers to rogue into tassel seed corn. And the second issue is whether Remington is obligated to comply with the working arrangement that was entered into between Remington's farm labor contractor and the migrant farm workers that he recruited to work in Remington's fields. And with respect to these two issues, we're challenging both the legal conclusion and some of the factual observations that were made by the district court. For example, with respect to the recruitment issue, I believe the court, in its opinion, stated that Remington had asked Mr. Zarate to bring a crew of 20 to 30 workers to come work in its field, but then it recruited that there was no, then it concluded that there was no authority for recruiting these workers. And with respect to both of these issues, one of the points we'd like to make is that with under the Agriculture Worker Protection Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act, and the cases that apply and interpret both of those laws, we believe that this case should be reversed because Remington chooses who to use as a farm labor contractor to detassel and rogue its seed corn, and Remington acknowledges in the agreements that it has with these contractors that the Agriculture Worker Protection Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act are applicable to this employment, but it delegates compliance with those laws to the labor contractors that it uses. And if it did, as in this case, if Remington chooses a labor contractor who basically is a fly-by-night operation and asks him to put together a crew of workers to rogue into tassel its seed corn and then advances that labor contractor a large sum of money to help with the recruitment activities, and that farm labor contractor really has no control over the amount of work that the crew is going to receive or the conditions of employment, no business capital, no business structure, and no equipment, then Remington is liable for the violations of the APA and the FLISA that arise from the employment and recruitment of those workers. And this is consistent with when Congress drafted the Fair Labor Standards Act, and later when they enacted the Agriculture Worker Protection Act, Congress used language that was drawn from state child labor laws that was designed to reach businesses that used middlemen to illegally hire and supervise children to work in their businesses. And they defined employee to include sufferer permit to work. And this language makes this definition the broadest definition of employee that has ever been used in any federal legislation. And this language sweeps in virtually all work done in an employer's business operation that the business knows of and prevents from being performed.
I don't follow that argument. Suppose Boeing hires Mayor Brown and Platt to do its legal work on the construction of some new airplane. And Mayor Brown and Platt sends a team of lawyers to Boeing's headquarters. Boeing is obviously permitting them to work. Are they now employees of Boeing for purposes of the Fair Labor Standards Act?
I don't believe so. I believe that the lawyers would be considered outside specialists that are brought in to perform a specialized task.
So you don't really believe this thing that anybody you permit to work on your premises is your employee under the Fair Labor Standards Act. That leads to the question, what distinguishes between Mayor Brown and Platt and Mr. Zarate?
Well, there would be several ways to distinguish. One is the Mayor Brown and Platt, I assume, is a substantial independent business. And I believe there is maybe one...
I suppose I should be saying Mayor Brown, Rowan Maw, but I'm trapped in an earlier usage. Sorry. Anyway, Mayor Brown is certainly substantial.
That would be one distinction.
The reason why I chose it. But that what your answer suggests that you're not really relying on this fact that you must be an employee if you show up on an employer's premises. Because otherwise, Mayor Brown, Rowan Maw are all employees of Boeing. And then the next day they're all employees of Ford Motor Company, and the next day they're all, right? It doesn't make any sense. Other than the fact that Zarate is thinly capitalized, what matters in trying to distinguish between Mayor Brown and Zarate in your view?
Maybe I don't know enough about the business operation you're asking or the question that you posed.
I gave you Mayor Brown because I assume you know about the practice of law.
Yes, Your Honor. One is the lawyers are evidently or apparently are educated, trained with specialized skills and knowledge, and the workers on Mr. Zanata's crew are not.
I don't know how that's going to help.
Well,
because Boeing has an internal legal staff, and they're all actually employees.
That's true, Your Honor, but sometimes you can bring in outside specialists who have some special knowledge, skill, or expertise. For example,
Do you think any of the standards in the Supreme Court's cases after our decision in Lauritzen, the Supreme Court's decisions in Clackamas Gastroenterology and Community for Creative Nonviolence, in both of those cases they're trying to identify what employees are for purposes of federal law. Your brief doesn't discuss them, but I wonder whether we should be paying some attention to the Supreme Court's post-Lauritzen efforts to define employees for purposes of federal law.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and in fact, we have in our brief we cited to Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company versus Darden, which was an ERISA case, I believe. And in that case, insurance agents were trying to show that they were labor employees for purposes of the ERISA statute. And in that statute, employees were defined. An employer was someone who employed an employee. It was a very circular sort of definition. And in Darden, the court stated that in response to the appellant's suggestion that they adopt this broad, expansive definition of the word employee, the Supreme Court stated that the Fair Labor Standards Act was different, that Congress had specifically reached back to child labor statutes and had adopted this broad, expansive definition of the word employee that included the phrase to suffer or permit to work.
Well, would it matter that even though neither of them owned the field, Remington had total control over the use of the field, whereas Zarate had no connection to it at all?
Well, I think, Your Honor, when you look at the factors that the court went through in trying to fathom what the exact relationship was, I think it would matter. But really what the test should be is whether the work that's performed is an integrated part of the production process. And if you look at Rutherford versus McComb, in that case, a slaughterhouse tried to evade FLISA liability by labeling its chief boner as a independent contractor and using him to hire, fire, supervise, pay, and employ a group of boners to trim the slaughterhouse's beef. And in this case, Remington's role is basically the same because they use a farm labor contractor. They label him as an independent contractor, use him to supervise, manage, pay, and provide direct supervision to the workers. So Remington's role in this case really is no different than the role of the slaughterhouse in Rutherford. And then with respect to the work that's performed by the workers themselves, in Rutherford, the boners, they didn't start to work until after the cattle had been slaughtered, skinned, dressed, and cooled. And after that, then they trimmed the meat. And then the meat was trimmed again, weighed, packed, and shipped off. And in this case, the same thing is true with respect to the seed corn. The farm workers don't begin their work until after the corn's been planted.
Let me try and see if I can synthesize your argument. Is it that the situation in this case is one in which Zarethe, in essence, is a middleman for Remington, who, you know, merely made arrangements for the workers to be where they needed and paid them with money that was supplied by Remington. Now, in my brother Easterbrook's example, would you call Mayor Brown and Platt a middleman?
I believe that they would be a middleman in the big context, but I don't think that distinction is really the important distinction. I think the fact that Mayor Brown is lawyers that they're bringing in who have specialized skill and knowledge and talents, and I assume under Judge Easterbrook's example that they're being brought in to deal with a specialized project. But it's also if you look at the
merger agreement.
And I think also, Judge, that you would look at the sort of work that the individuals are doing. For example, in this case, these workers are providing manual laborers. They're walking up and down rows of corn, plucking tassels. And this is very similar, actually. In our brief, we cited to Secretary of Labor versus Lauritzen, which we believe also controls in this case, because in that case, the issue was slightly different. It was whether individual pickle pickers were employees of a pickle grower, but rather than whether they were independent contractors. Well, in this case, our clients are employees of somebody, and the question is whether they're also employees of Remington.
Mr. Sanchez, what does the record show about the instruction and or supervision that Zarethe provided to these workers?
The district court found that Remington controlled the work that was done by this group of workers. This case was decided on summary judgment, and so basically it was decided on the pleadings that were submitted, affidavits, deposition testimony. Mm-hmm. In Remington's original motion, I think they cited probably about 20 or so facts. In our response, we cited 338 facts that we thought governed this relationship, which started off explaining what Remington was, what sort of business they were in, and went through the sorts of claims.
What does the record show? How did Zarethe handle a business day in the fields? Was he there at all?
The record shows that he was there, but he was there and no more. His role really was no more than a field foreman who could speak to the workers because he spoke Spanish. So, for example, one part of the record shows that the workers themselves, Mr. Zarethe didn't train the workers on his crew on how to walk up and down the rows and pull the tassels. That was done by Remington. One of Remington's managers, after an orientation session, sat down with the workers and explained to them how to do the work, with Mr. Zarethe merely translating for him. The records also shows that Remington controlled which fields these workers would go into on a daily basis. Remington decided whether a field was properly done. Remington decided whether they had to go and redo a field and how many times they had to redo it. Remington provided the buses that took them to and from the fields.
But during the course of a day, is there any evidence that Remington's employees actually supervised the actual detasseling process, walked up and down the rows while the workers were there?
I believe that there's very little evidence of that actual sort of day-to-day sort of contact. But there is evidence that Remington on a regular basis, checked the fields on a daily basis to make sure it was done properly. And there is one or two witnesses who testified for that they were given instructions by Remington's employees. For example, Daniel Reyes testified that on one occasion he was told that he was pulling too many leaves when he was pulling tassels. And at the worker orientation that was held for these workers, it was held at the Remington shed, and Remington's supervisor put on the orientation, explained the documents that they were going to fill out. But the point we're trying to make in this case, Your Honor, is that that sort of direct control really is not the dispositive issue in this case.
I understand that, but we've got to have something that shows that Remington is at least a co-employer. Or rather, and that's what I'm trying to find, is what was the comparative responsibility and what was the comparative interaction between of Cerrete and Remington with these people.
The record shows some minimal direct contact, Judge, but my take on the record is that Mr. Zarate really was nothing more than a field foreman, and that doesn't dictate whether there's liability in this case as an employer or not.
We know who did the hiring, who did the firing.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
We know who did the hiring, who did the firing.
Yes, Your Honor, but this is just like Rutherford versus McComb. In Rutherford versus McComb, the chief boner did the hiring and firing, yet the slaughterhouse could not escape employer liability. Your Honor, I'm entering the time for my
liability.
Excuse me, Judge.
Didn't escape what liability? I'm
employer liability under the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Shulman.
May it please the Court, my name is Donald Shulman, and I'm from Rensselaer, Indiana, and I practice law solely. I'm also joined by Mr. Hageman, who represents Remington Hybrid Seeds and himself personally. Mr. Overbeck is harvesting the crops currently. This case involves whether or not Remington is determined to be a joint employer. And that is the case.
Mr. Shulman, let me ask you a very bottom line question. Doesn't the district court's decision make it extremely easy for companies to avoid liability under the Act by setting up so-called independent contractors and making sure those contractors hand out the checks?
Well, the decision, as you know, was based upon these seven factors of the Martinez-Mendoza case. And I would suggest that it doesn't set up necessarily to avoid liability, but it gives parameters when one is in fact responsible for what they actually occurs. And that is, in essence, they would have to have some type of knowledge of what is going on and how these migrant workers in this particular case are being treated.
See, there's no question that Chief, in my mind at any rate, that Chief Judge McCuskey set out the factors. But it didn't seem to me that he applied them as liberally as the statute requires. And he didn't seem to tie them to the broader sufferer permit standard. A number of the factors that were weighed by the district court are close questions. Yet it didn't seem that the court analyzed them, taking all inferences in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, as summary judgment requires. And if you can help me with that, I'd be very grateful.
Okay. Well, in regards to the specific factors that were close, and I will just address the first factor for the court, which is, did Remington have the power to direct, control, and supervise them, which was questions posed to Mr. Sanchez. It's exclusively and undeniable that Mr. Zarate was the one that told him when to work. He told him how to work. He told him how long to work. He told him when to stop, when to start, and what to do in between. No Remington employee ever spoke to any of the plaintiffs, never gave them any supervision or direction during the course of their employment.
But am I wrong in thinking that Remington controlled the fields which were worked on and when, and determined whether the quality of the work was sufficient or whether it had to be redone, that it was the one, forgive me, who provided sanitary facilities in the field and provided guidance as to how that work was performed, both with there was that pesticide safety video and there were demonstrations at the field as to how the work should be performed. So, I mean, doesn't that cut against?
Well, specifically, I think that you have to, the courts have determined that you take everything and look at it as a whole. And in regards to the safety video that you mentioned, the holding in the Gonzalez versus Sanchez, 346 Fed 3rd 1107, specifically held that the showing of a video was not sufficient to demonstrate control. Secondly, the fact that Remington would indicate to Mr. Zarate which fields were ready to be detasseled at the time, that is, the quality of the tassel, and they would inspect it when no other people were in the field to determine whether they did a sufficient job. The holdings in the Martinez versus Mendoza case found that those were agricultural decisions and that a farmer can make that, and that isn't determined to be control over the workers. Further, in the Charles versus Burton case, in that particular matter, the farmer went out and inspected the fields 2 to 3 times a day, and that was held not to be controlled because it was, once again, an agricultural decision. In regards to supplying porta-johns, correct. Remington did, in fact, put porta-johns in the fields, not exclusively for Mr. Zarate's crew nor these 10 plaintiffs that were members of him, but for everybody, including their own employees, the ones who inspected it. And these facts are viewed with all of the other facts. And some of the facts that were held by those same two cases was whether or not a specific task was assigned, and it was not. And whether Remington had any influence over the hiring. Remington didn't even know the plaintiffs' names until after they were sued. They did not know Mr. Zarate contacted them when he did. They had no idea of what he said or what he promised. It was all done in the state of Texas before Mr. Zarate even came to the state of Indiana. And additionally, and by the way, on that particular factor, the district court found that Remington, that favored Remington being a joint employer. And it's our position that finding was, frankly, an error based upon all of the evidence that has been submitted that we feel is undisputed and now the law that interpreted those specific facts. Additionally, the other factors that the court relied upon. Did Remington have the right to hire, fire, and modify the terms of employment or pay them? Remington is undisputedly, did not pay them. Mr. Zarate determined their pay, wrote their checks, paid them, provided workman's compensation, exclusively supervised them. Remington, like I said, didn't know their names, didn't know when each one of the plaintiffs would show up to work and the others didn't know how long they would work, when they left.
But
they didn't know what job they did.
But Remington supplied Zarate with the money.
Remington did, in fact, pay Mr. Zarate. And that exact issue has been, I guess, addressed by the case entitled Amable versus 20 Fed 3rd 442, wherein that said the fact that a contractor received money and, in turn, in that situation, paid the workers, bought their workman's compensation factor, is not sufficient to establish the control of wages, which is set forth in that same factor.
Counsel, what turns on the disposition of this case? Zarate had to comply with the Fair Labor Standards Act and the Migrant Workers Protection Act. Mm-hmm. So if there are costs of complying with those statutes fully, Remington had to cover them, had to cover every cent of them in its contract with Zarate. So I'm trying to figure out what turns on the outcome of this case. Is it just what happens when the independent contractor is insolvent and the employer, in your case, the employer of the independent contractor, I'm using a common law sense, did not insist on a bond for the protection of the workers?
Well, I don't know that it turns on that. I think it turns on...
Well, if Zarate had complied with the Fair Labor Standards Act, that if he'd paid the workers their full due, yep, and he'd complied with the other statutes, you obviously wouldn't be on the hook for anything.
Well, in
and
fact...
you had to compensate Zarate for doing all of that. So I'm trying to figure out, is there any circumstance other than an insolvent independent contractor where the debate we are having in this case matters?
Well, I would suggest that it matters in each case, and any time a migrant worker would come to work in the fields anywhere. That's the importance of this
matter if the independent contractor is solvent?
I don't think it matters one bit whether he's solvent or
then
not.
Then your answer is it doesn't matter unless the independent contractor is solvent.
Well, in this particular
Remington
case...
Remington Seed has to pay in full one way or the other. It has to pay the workers in full through the independent contractor, or it has to pay the workers in full themselves. And presumably it can protect itself against the risk of insolvency by requiring its contractors to post a bond.
Okay.
All right, this is a simple application of the Coase theorem, in the event you aren't making it.
I guess I'm really not. I'm assuming the requirement of a bond is correct. However, Your Honor, in this particular case...
Well, so Remington can either protect itself or not. It can choose to protect itself, and in that event, no one will ever see this kind of litigation. Or if it chooses to hire a thinly capitalized, fly-by-night independent contractor, and the independent contractor doesn't pay its workers, then it can pay directly. I'm just trying to figure out why we should have 17-factor tests and huge legal expenditures when this seems to be very simple and quite capable of something that can be readily resolved by contract.
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, 7 of the 10 plaintiffs, including the heads of each family, testified that they were, in fact, paid for all the work they did. So I don't see
that...
Well,
then they don't have any claim, and you don't have to worry about them.
Well, that's exactly what the evidence revealed after their depositions.
Then why is Remington paying you to fight a claim where the damages are zero? It doesn't... This whole thing is very puzzling to me.
Well, Your Honor, as the court is aware, the assertion of litigation against the party doesn't end just because you want it to. If it proceeds on further, you have to defend yourself. And for Remington's standpoint, this is a very important matter.
One ready way to defend yourself in a case where the damages are zero is to say the damages are zero. Dismiss the case.
Well, as you know, a defendant doesn't have that opportunity.
Certainly it does.
To attempt to address your issues, the courts before us, especially in the most recent 2003 holding, did set forth these factors, and these are the factors that the district court addressed. And Remington's position is that when taking those factors as a whole, as the court did, it determined that it wasn't a joint employer. And I can also distinguish the facts succinctly from the Rosenthal case, which I believe Your Honor was on.
It makes no difference which members of this court are on which panels of the court.
In that holding, Your Honor, the farmer himself dealt directly with the plaintiffs in that case. He paid them directly. He provided housing for them directly. He assigned them specific tasks. He gave them specific plots. He gave them the tools to do their work. And in that case, he even gave them the trucks to carry the pickles. And the facts in the Remington case are dramatically different. None of those exist. Remington didn't have anything to do directly with any of these plaintiffs. As I stated, they didn't even know their names until the litigation was filed. They only dealt with Mr. Zarate under an independent contractor agreement that set forth specifically what his rights and duties were. That is, that he was independent for all purposes, that he shouldn't hold himself out to be a representative or employee of Remington, that he wasn't, that he was responsible for any labor that he may choose to bring with him for all purposes, and thus why he was set up that Mr. Zarate was in fact paid. And in fact, in this particular matter, Remington paid Mr. Zarate $9,000 at the end of the work so he could pay all his workers, including these plaintiffs, which were verified by the plaintiff's own testimony that they were paid for what they did. Additionally, the other important factor I would suggest is that whether or not the activities, that is, detasseling, was an integral part of Remington's business. The court found that detasseling was a small part of the overall operation of raising seed corn. Obviously,
reason, by the way, why in this particular business, where there's a risk of defaults by subcontractors, the firms like Remington don't use the normal approaches that are taken by general contractors or employers in construction cases?
Remington's in what way, Your Honor?
If you hire somebody to build a building on Remington's property, if Remington hires somebody to build a building, it will not only require the general contractor to post a bond for the benefit of the subcontractors and their employees, it will also have holdbacks. That is, it won't pay the general contractor 100%. It will pay only on certification that all the subs and all their employees have been paid and all liens released. Right? Remington is in trouble in this case because it didn't make sure that all the employees got paid before it paid Zarate in full. But I'm just wondering why, given that this non-payment of subcontractors and their employees is an established problem with an established solution in one line of business, why doesn't Remington use those solutions?
Well, Your Honor, I guess it's never... I can't say that they hadn't considered that. I don't know that they've considered that. But I don't want the court to be misled that this case is based upon the fact that these 10 individuals were not paid. I do not believe. I believe undisputedly.
If they were given their due under the Fair Labor Standards Act, then it's nothing to litigate about.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the plaintiffs would suggest that there's other things to litigate about also. One, their housing arrangements. There's other issues. Remington has been, I guess, for the lack of a better term, sued on the shotgun approach. That is, everything in the Agricultural Worker and Protection Act that they could assert, they did assert. They asserted, for example, that we didn't post signs. And I believe the testimony unequivocally from the plaintiffs themselves, that they saw the signs on these porta-johns that we put in the conference room, by the way, where the video was shown. We were also sued based upon personal liability. We were sued based upon the housing that Remington had no knowledge where they in fact lived. It wasn't until they took their deposition 2 years, 2.5 years after this occurred that Remington determined that they lived not even in the state of Indiana but in the state of Illinois. And they determined then that they were put in two different residences. None of the plaintiffs ever communicated with anybody from Remington, never complained one thing about any of the things that are asserted in the litigation to us.
Mr. Shulman, you alluded several moments ago to the fact that Remington paid $9,000, I believe it was, to this fellow Zarate in order to ensure that all the workers were paid.
That's correct.
Was that over, was that over and above the price per acre?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And Mr. Girardi still owes Remington that sum of money, as we said here today.
So it was an advance. It was a loan.
As you may. It was something that Remington did to ensure that the workers that performed the work would be paid. Because Mr. Girardi came and indicated that he needed more money despite the fact he was paid what he was supposed to have been paid under the agreement.
And am I correct that you also had to advance him $5,000 to procure the appropriate
compensation insurance? That's correct.
Is this common in the industry?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. The advancement of that sum of money was for that specific purpose. As the court's aware, the agreement requires him to comply with all these laws. Knowing that, that's why the money was advanced. And by the way, as you will see, all these sums of money are paid all within, let's say, a 5-week period, all because detasseling occurs, let's use July 4th, starting a week or week and a half before to 2 to 3 weeks thereafter. That's the only window you have to detassel seed corn, and it's dependent upon the weather conditions when it actually comes ready to be detasseled. So why it all occurs in a relatively quick period of time. Additionally, the other factor is whether or not tasseling in and of itself was integral to the business. As this court may be aware or may not be aware, what it takes to raise a kernel of corn, it starts the year before when you have to chisel plow the fields, then followed by next year where you field cultivate. You then plant the female rows, followed by about 2 weeks later by the male rows, followed by permitting fertilizer and chemicals to it. Then comes the tasseling once it matures a little more. Thereafter, the male rows are then cut out. Harvesting occurs, and thereafter the corn is put on the cob, is sorted, and it is then taken and dried. Then the corn is removed from the cob itself. Then it is conditioned by putting chemicals on it, then taken to being bagged, and then from bagging, bean wrapping, palletized, stored in a warehouse.
You don't get hybrid corn unless you detassel, do you?
That's correct.
So, and this is your client is in the process of manufacturing hybrid corn, or at least in those fields.
Raising that, that's correct.
I see.
And the corn, by the way, just for your knowledge, can also be tasseled, besides manually, like it has here, also by machines. That is, machines come in and they either cut the corn off, cut the tassels off, or they actually have pullers.
The current state of the art, is that considered an efficient way of detasseling, to do it mechanically?
Well, yes, it is. And however, the use of workers to go in, even after doing all that, to do that is also something that is, I will say, common in the industry to ensure that. Because the important thing is to have the purity. That is, not to have it, pollinated by another type of,
So it's considered that there's less chance of error if it's done by human hands than
exactly. Exactly. That's the purpose of that. In all of these factors, with the exception I save two, the court found that Remington was not a joint employer. The first one I touched on earlier, we felt that the court, despite what the facts were and then the law applicable to those particular matters, that Remington should not have been determined to be favoring, I would say, joint employer status. The last of which was one, whether it was occurred over a period of time. However, that one, the decree in permanency, has been held by two other courts, the Charles case and the Amiable case, to be irrelevant, in their opinion, in coming to that determination of joint employer status. And the other the factor that was considered was whether or not the services were rote or repetitive. Likewise, the Martinez-Mendoza case of 2003 found that factor also to be irrelevant and determining when one was a joint employer. And those
are
the two.
Mr. Shulman, where do you stand on this issue of who actually gave the instruction, albeit minimal, to the workers? Was that your people or was that Mr. Zaretti?
In two different ways, Your Honor. There was, in fact, a safety video shown for all workers, not just Mr. Zaretti's crew, but for everybody.
Everybody, yeah.
9 of 10 of the plaintiffs saw that safety video. Mm-hmm. And as I previously said, there was a holding that says that doesn't exercise control. Now, concerning the actual pulling of a tassel, first of all, this isn't the first time these plaintiffs has detasseled seed corn. They've done it many times before. And as you're well aware, it requires taking your hand and pulling or breaking the tassel off. It doesn't take a lot of skill. There, I believe, one of Remington's employees did in fact go to the field and demonstrated how to pull it off, and I think the demonstration was not to leave it there. And he did that to Mr. Zaretti, who then showed it. I believe that, in fact, did occur. Okay. However, I believe that there is a specific holding, I believe it was the Charles case, saying that minimal instruction in that particular does not exercise enough control for that particular factor. It's our position that merely showing them on one occasion not to leave any of the tassels themselves remaining on the plant does not go above the minimal instruction, by the way, which was given to Mr. Zaretti. There was no other instruction given by any employee of Remington or officer of Remington at any other time to any of these plaintiffs. They weren't there during the day when they were working. They only came and looked at the fields afterward to ensure the fact that the tassels were pulled. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Shulman.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Sanchez?
I'd like to address just a few points that were made by Mr. Shulman. For example, with respect to whether the crop is machine detasseled, corn can be machine detasseled, but you can't obtain the level of purity that you need to produce a marketable seed corn crop, so you have to hand detassel, and that's why these workers are used. With respect to the pay, it's true that Mr. Zaretti wrote out checks to these workers. The checks are in the record, and they're in his handwriting. But he didn't write checks until money had been wired into his account by Remington. And prior to the start of the season, prior to he started his recruitment activities, he was given $5,000 to purchase workers' compensation insurance. And when he showed up with his crew of workers Before he even started working, he was given another $3,000. And then during the season, before he was entitled to any pay under his agreement with Remington, money was wired into his account, I believe $12,000 worth for the month, the first month of work. And then at the end of the season, he was given $9,000 more than he had actually earned to pay these workers. So when Remington says that they don't know any, they have no knowledge of who these workers are or whether they got paid or whether they didn't get paid, that's really not accurate. And the same is true with respect to the issue of damages. Remington says there were no damages in this case. Well, this case was decided on summary judgment, and it was decided on the issue that's before the court, and that's whether Remington employed these workers. So the court didn't really get to the issue of damages. However, after the fact, the workers in this case were granted a default judgment against Mr. Zarate in the amount of almost $115,000, so there were damages in this case. And part of those damages were for violations of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which I believe were relatively minor. But one claim under that act was that when the workers attended the orientation session, that they weren't paid. This orientation session was held at the Remington facility, and it was held put on by Remington's employees, and they filled out forms that said and were told they were going to be working for Remington. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.